last time we spent some time talking about how that God has dealt with the nation of Israel as a son. He talks about Jacob being his son, and even down many centuries after the man Jacob died, he still keeps talking about his descendants as though it is the man Jacob, you know, collectively as a whole. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, I pointed this out before, when Moses was sent to Pharaoh, God says, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed, I will kill your son, your firstborn. And we know that's exactly what happened finally, wasn't it? God ended up killing all the firstborn, including Pharaoh's, because he wouldn't let the children of Israel go. Now, we talked a little bit about how that a son or a child has an inheritance, but also that that child or that son has to be trained, disciplined, and ultimately before he can receive an inheritance. You know, if God was to give the nation of Israel all the promises that he had promised to Abraham all at once without teaching them and training them and instructing them and disciplining them, then do you think they would have handled the inheritance appropriately?
No.
It's like somebody who's training to be a pilot. You know, somebody's going to train to be a pilot, you can say, okay, well, I'm going to give you an airplane and you're going to fly the airplane. So you just, you know, give him an airplane. You don't do that, right? They have to go to school. They have to learn. They have to get in a flight simulator. They have to be disciplined, and then they have to be proven before you entrust them with a 747 full of passengers, right? Because that's a great responsibility. And the inheritance that God promised to Abraham and his seed is a great responsibility. He's going to entrust the whole world to Abraham and his seed one day when he destroys the wicked. And of course, with the Messiah ruling as well. And so God took his son, Israel, he calls him his firstborn son, and he took him through a long history of instruction and discipline. Now, what I want to do today is I want to look at how God has done this over the centuries. And I want you to see that he starts laying a foundation of training and instruction with the nation of Israel, and then gradually he's building and building on that foundation until we come to the time of Christ. And as with any child, sometimes punishment is appropriate, and sometimes extremely severe punishment is appropriate, and God has done that as well. And we have all this history in the Bible that bears this out. All the history in the Old Testament, really, starting with Abraham, all the way up to the time of Christ, is God teaching, instructing, and disciplining his firstborn son, Jacob, Israel, the nation of Israel. Okay? So let's look at how that began to develop. So let's take our Bibles first and go to Genesis chapter 15. Now, this is part of the covenant that God made with Abraham, but when God, you know, God gave Abraham all these wonderful promises, like, you know, I'm going to make of you a great nation, your seed, I'm going to bless your seed abundantly, through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed, I'm going to give you and your descendants all this land as an everlasting possession, all these things that God promised. Did he start fulfilling all the blessings immediately? No, he didn't. All right. Now, yes, Abraham did have a son, Isaac, and God blessed Isaac. But we see something beginning to happen even from the moment that Isaac was born, from the moment that God began to fulfill the promises that he made to Abraham. We see some negative things beginning to happen, and they were intentional. God wanted them to those things to happen. In fact, before Isaac was even born, God told Abraham that his seed was going to undergo some very hard times. He told them right off the bat. In fact, look at Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. Now, verse 13. Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." So before Israel came out with great possessions and began to receive a lot of these blessings from God, there was going to be a period of 400 years of suffering. That's what he said right off the bat. And actually, if you do a chronological study of the Bible, you will see that that 400 years actually started with the birth of Isaac, from the moment he was born. Now, I want you to go over to chapter 21 of Genesis. Verse 8. So the child grew and was weaned. This is Isaac. And Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac." And the matter was very displeasing to in Abraham's sight because of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not let it be displeasing to you in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed will be called," and so forth. And we hear if you continue reading, the story is that, you know, he sent Ishmael and Hagar away and so forth. But from the moment, here's Isaac, he's been breastfeeding, and his older brother Ishmael is mocking him, and of course Hagar, I'm certain, had something to do with that as well. We learn from Paul in Galatians chapter 4. So did Isaac continue to be persecuted, not by Ishmael, but did he continue to be persecuted? Yes, he did. Go over to chapter 26. As an adult, verse 12. Then Isaac sowed in the land, and he reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. So here's Isaac as a young man, and he's planting crops, and God is abundantly blessing his crops and his animals and so forth. The man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous, for he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and a great number of servants. So the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, and they had filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." Then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father called them. Also Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. And the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that also. So he called its name Sitnah. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehoboth, because they said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." Then he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now, how many wells are these guys digging? See, here's what happens. You've got Isaac. He doesn't have a whole lot. But God begins to bless him, and he begins to farm his land, and God starts giving him abundant crops. Now, you have to understand that when Abraham was called by God to leave his homeland and go out and live in this land that afterwards he was going to give him as an everlasting possession, you have to understand that Abraham is the foreigner. Okay, he's a foreigner living in a foreign land amongst people, and they know this Abraham guy, he's not one of us. He's a foreigner, all right? And his son Isaac is a foreigner. Abraham and Isaac, and later Jacob, the Hebrews 11 says that they lived as foreigners in the land of promise, living in tents. They didn't even build a permanent house. They could have. Everybody else pretty much lived in houses. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived in tents. And they did so because they understood themselves to be foreigners living in a land that was not yet theirs, but one day God was going to give it to them. All right. And so you've got this foreigner, Isaac, now, after Abraham died, and the people around them are treating them badly, are treating Isaac badly. And so you've got these, Abraham had dug wells and so forth, and these guys come in, and just out of meanness, they go in and fill in the wells. You know, when you have a lot of flocks, a lot of herds, you need a lot of water. And if you have crops too, but you need a lot of water to feed, to water your animals, right? And so what they were doing is they were jealous of the fact that here's a foreigner living in our midst, and he's getting wealthy on our land, basically. He's getting wealthy on our land. He's, you know, God was not prospering these other people in the way that he was prospering Isaac. And so they got all jealous about it, and so they start, you know, treating him badly and filling in the wells. And so what does he do? He doesn't fight over it and demand it. He moves somewhere else. Okay, here's an area out here where, you know, there's nobody's out here. I'm not bothering anybody. I'll keep my animals out here. They'll graze here, and we'll dig another well so I can water my animals. Well, then they come and they fill in that well. You know, they're chasing him around and treating him pretty badly, okay? Well, this is the kind of stuff that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had to put up with while they were foreigners living in this land that was not theirs at the time, but God had promised that he was going to give it to them as an everlasting possession. And they're still waiting for that promise, by the way, metaphorically speaking, but they haven't received it yet, and they will receive it in the resurrection. All right, but God, so you can see how at the same time they're being blessed, they're being persecuted. Isn't that right? Well, let's continue reading in chapter 27. Now, of course, Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau, right? Esau despised his birthright, and so the blessing of Abraham, the covenant of Abraham, went to Jacob. And so God began to bless Jacob. Well, look at 27, verse 41. So Esau, that is Jacob's brother, hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." And the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to your brother Laban in Haran, and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you, and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. Why should I be bereaved also of both in one day?" And Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life," because this is Isaac, by the way. He's on his deathbed, okay? Their father, Isaac, he's about to die. Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, like these who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me?" So basically, she's sending Jacob away. Here's Isaac. He's very old. He's blind. He's about to die. Jacob and Esau are there, you know, in the last moments of their father's life. And Rebekah knows that Esau is plotting to kill his brother as soon as his father is dead. And so she tells Isaac that she wants to send Jacob away to find a wife from her father's family rather than from the people of that area, right? So that's what happens. They send him away. Well, so Jacob here is being persecuted or about to be persecuted by his brother, who hated him because the birthright went to him instead of Esau. So what happens when Jacob that now gets to Laban, his mother's brother's family in a faraway place? He gets there. He gets persecuted there. You guys probably know the story, but Laban, his mother's father, or brother, sorry, his mother's brother, When Jacob gets there, he's looking for a wife, and he sees Rachel, and he wants to marry her, and so he makes an arrangement with her father to work for 7 years in exchange for his daughter Rachel. Well, on their wedding night, this man Laban pulls a fast one on him, right? You guys are laughing. Back in those days, the women were veiled. Their faces and everything were veiled. And so during the wedding ceremony, you can't see who it is. And so, she's standing there and they do whatever. I don't know how their vows worked. But then part of the customs with the Jewish weddings was that the, I shouldn't say Jewish weddings because they weren't Jews at this point yet. But part of the customs of those people was that part of the ceremony was that the bride and the groom would go into a little tent and they would take care of business, if you understand, in the tent as part of the wedding ceremony while everybody is feasting around them. Sounds kind of weird, but they did that. And the feasting would go on for 7 days. So they consummated their marriage in the tent privately. And so forth. And then, they feasted for 7 days. Well, of course, Jacob, he gets who he thinks is Rachel into the tent and, uncovers her. And voila, it's her sister Leah. And so anyway, he wasn't very happy about that. But anyway, long story short, you guys know the story. He has to make another deal to get the one he wanted in the first place, to work 7 more years to get her, So he's being taken advantage of. Now, if you continue reading the life of Jacob during this time, he's tending Laban's flocks, okay? And God begins to bless everything he does and multiply it. And so whatever portion of the flock that he is put in charge of, they start bearing lots of offspring, and they're good and healthy and all that kind of stuff, while the rest of the flock is not doing too good. And so what happens is Laban keeps manipulating their arrangement so that he benefits. Every time he makes an arrangement with him, God blesses Jacob, but not Laban. And so Laban comes along and changes the conditions of their arrangement again so that he'll benefit from it, and then God switches it again so that now whatever the new arrangement was, Jacob's small flock begins to get bigger and bigger. And so what happens is Jacob begins to become more wealthy than his father-in-law, and of course this causes tension and so forth. Well, let's look at what the text says here. Look at Genesis chapter 31. Verse 1. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has acquired all his wealth. So you can see there's jealousy going on between Laban's sons, the brothers of Jacob's wife. They're saying, Jacob is taking away all the wealth of our father, but the fact of the matter is, every time they made a deal, God blessed Jacob and whatever deal that was made in Jacob's favor. So it was God doing it. Jacob wasn't doing anything wrong. Verse 2, and Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable towards him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable towards me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. Isn't that funny? So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at that time when the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream. I'm not going to go into that. He talks about how God gave him a prophecy that this was going to happen, and how he saw it in a dream that it was going to happen, and it happened exactly as he said. Now go down to verse 38. So he takes his wives and his children, because he had children by this time, and his flocks, and he leaves, and he sneaks out, leaves at night. Verse 38. Then Laban, of course, catches up to him, pursues after him, and they're about to have a little skirmish there. So here's the conversation, verse 38. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. In the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and my labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. Now, that's a pretty good summary of 20 years of Jacob's life under the thumb of his father-in-law, Laban, who mistreated him continually, yet God blessed him even in the midst of being mistreated. This was a very important lesson. Now, I want you to go to Genesis chapter 32. You remember last time we were talking about how that this mysterious person keeps showing up and interacting with Abraham and his seed. In Genesis, earlier in Genesis, we saw that this person named Melchizedek, king of Salem, which Hebrews chapter 7 says was Christ, shows up and confirms a covenant with Abraham that God gave him. And they actually took bread and wine together, and Abraham paid a tithe, 10% of his what he had recovered. He paid that to Melchizedek, who Hebrews says was Christ. Well, this person shows up again in Genesis chapter 32 with regard to Jacob. Verse 22. And he arose that night, this is Jacob, and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. So he sent all his flocks and his wives and his kids, he sent them over ahead of him across this small river. And here he is by himself. Verse 24, and then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip. That is, this man, he was wrestling, and he wasn't defeating Jacob. Jacob was struggling pretty hard. So he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he, that is Jacob, said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me, what is your name, I pray?" And he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Isn't that amazing? So we have, not only is God appeared to Isaac and reaffirmed the covenant that he made with Abraham to Isaac, he appeared to Jacob. Remember the ladder? Jacob saw the vision of the ladder and the angels ascending and descending, and then God spoke to him, and he reaffirmed the covenant that he had made with Abraham, with Jacob. Now here he is, and that was on his way to get a wife from Laban. Now he's on his way back with his wives, with his children, with his flocks and his herds, and now this man again blesses him on the way back, this mysterious stranger that keeps showing up. Now let's go over to Exodus chapter 1. You guys, I'm sure you guys know the story, but there was, as Jacob began to get older, his sons got older, there was a famine in the land. And we read these in the last chapters of Genesis. There was a famine there, and so Joseph was sold into slavery. Joseph was, at the time, was the youngest son of Jacob. He was sold into slavery by his brothers, who conspired against him. And he went down to Egypt, and through all that happened in Egypt, he ended up becoming a very important official in the land of Egypt during the famine. I'm sure you guys all know that story, right? Okay. Well, later, because of the famine, Jacob and the rest of his sons have to go down to Egypt because that's the only place where you can get food. So they go down into Egypt, and they move down there, and they discover that Joseph is an important official, and he vows to take care of his whole family in Egypt. Well, after a while, the Pharaoh that was friendly to Jacob passed away. Let's pick up the story in Exodus 1:1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. He's talking about grandsons and so forth as well, all right? And Joseph died, and his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field, all their service in which they made them serve with rigor. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Sifra, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mightily. And it was so because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." And you guys know the whole story of this. But the persecution begins to, it increases and increases and increases until it becomes absolutely unbearable for the children of Israel in Egypt, until finally God sends them Moses to deliver them out of bondage. You know, look at what it says there, lesson one. From the birth of Isaac until God sent Moses to deliver them out of Egypt was 400 years. It was 400 years of being mocked, being mistreated, being cheated, and being slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt during that 400 years. But what was the lesson from that?
God still blessed them all through it.
He did at the beginning, but at the end it got harder and harder. Right? I mean, during the time in Egypt, there wasn't a whole lot of blessing. I mean, he was still providing for them, but they were being beaten. And you guys have seen the movie, The Ten Commandments, right? You see how the slavery was working there. It was nasty. But what was the lesson? It's on the screen, people. Lesson one. Before they could appreciate what God was going to do for them, they first needed to be on the receiving end of injustice and persecution. Before you can appreciate anything of value, sometimes you need to first be at the other end of the spectrum for a while, right? Isn't that right? Well, the first lesson was what it feels like to be on the receiving end of injustice, of persecution. What were the children of Israel longing for while they were in Egypt being persecuted this way? What were they longing for? Freedom and justice. Justice. Because they were being treated unjustly. Right? Isn't that right? They wanted freedom and they wanted justice. Before they could truly appreciate freedom, the value of freedom, before they could truly appreciate the value of justice, of people being treated as they ought to be treated, rightly, and punished when they deserve to be punished, before they could appreciate those things, they first needed to be on the receiving end of injustice. And this is why God put them through that for 400 years. Yes, Walter? Assuming that they had a historical record of that, because this is generations later. They probably had some knowledge of it orally, but you have to understand that none of these books were written at that time. The books were written after the fact. Moses wrote these books after God delivered them out of Egypt while they were in the wilderness. That's when Moses wrote this down, okay? So, what's that? And the whole story of Abraham and all that, it was written down by Moses later. So, but anyway, yeah, no doubt they had some oral tradition about it as well, and the promises. And you know, I think the fact that God had told Abraham that this first lesson was going to last 400 years, he told him that. We read that in Genesis 15. That afterwards, after the 400 years, he was going to bring them out with great possessions. That if that had been passed down orally, which probably it did, would give them some hope, I would expect, right? In the midst of all that. Well, that was the first lesson. Well, what's the second lesson that God then gave the children of Israel? And that is, who is this God of Abraham anyway? You know, I'm sure they heard the stories about, you know, the God who appeared to our forefather Abraham. And, you know, he made all these promises to him. But who is this God? And is he really going to fulfill his promises? Or was he just blowing smoke? Or, you know, is he really a God after all anyway? You know, it's one thing. Here's one of the problems with this son that God calls Israel. The problem is when God teaches one generation certain lessons and they see what God does and they can see what God can do. Like Abraham, you know, he interacted directly with God. But when that person dies and their son is born, their son has no knowledge, no experiential knowledge of this God. So whatever experiences and knowledge was gained by experience from the father, the son doesn't have that. Isn't that right? He doesn't have any of that. And the son who's born is going to say, well, yeah, you told me all these stories and stuff, but how do I know that's true? Isn't that right? Some sons do that. And so it's up to the father to teach the son. It's very important. It's extremely important that the knowledge gained by experience be passed on to the next generation, which is one of the reasons why God commanded the children of Israel to observe all the festivals, because the festivals commemorated the great works that God had done in the history of the people. And so they were done, you know, with illustrations like Passover and so forth, with illustrations about the plagues and how God delivered them out of Egypt and all that. And this information is being passed down to the children year after year after year as they observe those festivals, which is why traditions are important. Good traditions, I should say, are important to train the next generation in using symbols and allegory. All right, because these are powerful tools, teaching tools. All right, so who is this God? Lesson two was, who is this God? So Moses, you know the story. I'm not going to turn to the passages because we don't have the time. But Moses is out in the desert, and he sees a bush burning, right? He sees a burning bush, and he's like, he's watching off in the distance. It's up on a mountain. It's actually on Mount Sinai. And he sees this bush burning, and he's watching it for a while, and it's just burning, and it never burns up. Now, you know, a dried up bush, if you put a match to it, is going to go up in like, you know, 30 seconds, and it's gone, right? Well, this bush is burning and burning and burning and burning and burning and burning, and Moses is tending his flock, and he's watching this bush up on the mountain, and it just keeps burning. And it's burning and burning, and, you know, probably hours go by, and Moses is like, okay, something weird's going on here. So he goes up to the mountain, and what happens? God starts to speak to him out of the bush and tells him that he's going to send him back to Egypt to deliver his people from Egypt. But who is this God? And how does Moses know that this God is, you know, can do what he claims? I mean, yeah, okay, you got a burning bush. That's pretty impressive. But, you know, what else are you going to do? Well, you guys know the whole story about the plagues, right? God sent plagues upon Egypt, plague after plague after plague. Moses kept telling Pharaoh, you know, God says, Israel's my firstborn son. Let my son go, that he may go and serve me. And Pharaoh hardens his heart, and so God sends a plague. And then Pharaoh cries uncle, and God removes the plague, and then he won't let him go again. And, you know, there's this thing going back and forth, 10 plagues. Back and forth. Now, who's watching all this? Not just the Egyptians, but the Israelites. They're watching all this. They're watching Moses. They're watching God send plague after plague after plague upon the Egyptians. And they're learning a little bit of something about this God that sent Moses to deliver them, right? So, finally, you know the story of Passover. And he delivers them out of Egypt. The Egyptians finally say, after he kills all their firstborn sons, the Egyptians say, take our stuff, take our gold, take everything, just go, get out of here before we're all dead. And so Moses takes them. And then what happens? Pharaoh changes his mind again. There they are at the Red Sea. And Pharaoh changes his mind again, and he says he's not going to let these Israelites make a fool out of him. And so he brings his army down on him. He's going to kill them all. And what does God do? He opens the Red Sea so they can pass through. What an impressive sight. I mean, you've got all these Israelites coming out of Egypt with their back against the sea, about to be killed by Pharaoh's army, and God opens up the sea so they can go through. That's pretty impressive, God, don't you think? He's showing them who he is. He's showing them his power. He's showing them his love and his commitment and his promises. I want you to look at Exodus chapter 12. I'm sorry, no. Exodus chapter 14. Verse 8. Now, I'm not going to read all that because we talked about some of it already. Verse 13. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. In other words, you don't have to fight. You don't have to draw a sword. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they will follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the now notice this, verse 19. This is the mysterious stranger showing up again. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. And so it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. So here they are passing through the Red Sea, and this pillar of cloud and fire is dividing between them, and it allows the Israelites to escape through the Red Sea. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea, and so forth. And then you know the story. After they had gone over, Moses stretched his rod out again, as the armies of Pharaoh were down in the Red Sea pursuing after them, and the sea came in and wiped them all out. God took out the whole army in one quick move. Pretty remarkable stuff. Didn't you see the movie? Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. Was it Yul Brynner?
Yeah, but was it accurate?
No. Huh? That part was. Yeah, no, Pharaoh was not killed in that. No, his army was. So, all right. So, what kind of a messenger is this? I mean, what kind of a God is this? What kind of a God can do that? You know, the one of the things about the prophets, when they talk about the pagan gods of all the nations, is how that they can't speak, they can't hear. They have to be carried because they can't even walk, right? They've got these idols. Their gods can't do anything. And yet they worship them. And then here's the God of Israel. He doesn't need an idol. He doesn't need an idol to represent him. He represents himself, right? With plagues, with parting the Red Sea. I mean, all these things that God did for Israel, he displayed his power in a amazing way during that deliverance out of Egypt, right? At the end of that time of trial and so forth. Now, they learned some important lessons about who this God was. Not only that, after they crossed over, they came to Mount Sinai, where Moses had originally seen the burning bush. And so God has them camp out there, and God says to Moses, I want you to tell the people that, you know, after 3 days, I'm going to come down on the mountain. And so God came down on the mountain. It says that the mountain was covered with smoke and fire. He had a bush burning the first time. Well, the second time when he appeared to the whole nation of Israel, it was such an amazing display. There was lightning, there was smoke, there was fire, and then there was a blast of a trumpet that was so loud that Moses said, my knees are shaking. I am extremely afraid. Hebrews talks about this. You know, it was so loud. And then God spoke in this booming voice out of the mountain. And all the people were so afraid, they covered their ears and they ran to Moses and said, Moses, you go talk to God. And then you come and tell us what he said, because we're all afraid we're going to die. That was the scene there. God showed his power, his glory, and he also showed something else in that whole deliverance of his people from Egypt, and that was his compassion for them. Isn't that right? In fact, when he appeared to Moses at the burning bush, he said, I have seen the suffering of my people, and I'm sending you to bring them out. So, God knows the suffering and with a mighty and powerful hand he delivered them. They should have fallen down and worshiped this God. They really should have. But what did they do when God called Moses up into the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments? What did they do? They made a golden calf. They made an idol, and they said, well, you know, they were used to idols. I mean, in a way, you have to say, you know what, I can understand why they would do that, because when they were back in Egypt, all the gods of the Egyptians were idols, and they had a temple to this god, to Ra, and to, you know, whatever, the sun god, and all that. They had all these different temples, all these different gods, and they had their idols, and so, you know, the Israelites come out, and, you know, they see all this miraculous stuff, and they want to make an idol of their god. And so they do that. And God got pretty furious about that, didn't he? He took care of that. But anyway, who this God is was something that God demonstrated for them in an amazing and incredible way. He's teaching them, you know, you can teach somebody by reading words in a book, but you can teach somebody by showing them. God showed them, right? He showed them. Now, lesson number three was, what does true justice look like? See, the children of Israel suffered injustice for a long time. And then this God of such mighty works, such magnificent power, delivers them out of Egypt just as he said he would, in the exact time he said he would. He brings them out of Egypt through all these signs and wonders that he did. And then what does he do? The very first thing he does is he gives them his law. And what was his law intended to do? To show them what true justice looks like. And you know, over and over, we could look at passages, but I've already gone over time. But over and over in the Old Testament, he tells them how they are to behave. And he says, you shall not oppress the poor. You shall not, for example, he told them that they had to, they could have slaves if somebody owed them a debt. That person could become their slave for a period of time to work off their debt. But he put a maximum limit on that. 7 years is the limit. You cannot exceed 7 years. And even with loans, if somebody owes you money for more than 7 years, at the end of 7 years, the debt has to be canceled. All right? God put limits on everything. You will not oppress a stranger. That is a foreigner. You do not oppress a foreigner. And he said, why did he say that? He says, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt and you were oppressed. You know what it feels like. You need to look at it from their perspective. In order to look at it from their perspective, they had to be on that end of it for a while. You guys understand that? See, to appreciate God's law, to appreciate the true justice that God gave for the nation of Israel, they first needed to experience injustice. Once they did that, once they knew who this God was and his magnificent power, and then he gives them his law, which shows them how to interact with their fellow man and also how to interact with foreigners. And it was always with justice. You know, he gave the law an eye for an eye. All those things were intended to show that justice is equal to the crime. You don't punish somebody excessively. You punish them only for what's equal or equitable for the crime. I want to show you one quick passage, and then we'll be done. Look at Leviticus chapter 19. Excuse me. I think this is the one I want. Verse 35. Yeah. You shall do no injustice in judgment, in measurement of length, width, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, and honest ephah. Now, what we're talking about is, you know, things were, when you sold something to somebody, they use scales to weigh it out, right? And a scale would have weights that you put on one side, and then you weigh the, you know, whatever you're selling, grain or whatever it is, on the other side. And, you know, this, if this weight is marked, you know, 1 kilogram, it better be 1 kilogram. All right? So that you don't cheat somebody. So you say, oh, you know, you rig your scale so that, Or it's like, you know, at the gas pump, you know, if it's rigged so that it says, you know, it's $2.99 a gallon, but really they got it rigged so you're only getting, you know, 3/4 of a gallon for that price. That's not honest, right? So the point is, in everything they did, in all their financial transactions, in everything they did with amongst themselves, with their brothers, and also even with foreigners, God absolutely demanded and required that they did it justly and honestly, all right, and openly. And so you could summarize the whole law of Moses in these verses right here, that they must have honest scales. Everything had to be just and honest. And then I want to look at chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. Verse 1. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. And he shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Of a foreigner you may require it, but you shall give up your claim to what is owed by your brother. Isn't that amazing? Not only that, you know, did you know that God even forbid the Israelites from charging interest on loans? They could do it with a foreigner, but they could not do it amongst their brothers. No interest. You know why? Proverbs says that the borrower is a slave to the lender. Isn't that what the proverb says that?
True.
And it's absolutely true. Because whenever you have a debt, you have an obligation to that person. And that obligation, until that obligation is met, you are a slave to them. If you have a house, you're a slave to the mortgage company. If you don't pay, they're going to come and take your house. Okay? That's how it works. Now, in old times, they would simply take you and make you work in their field until you paid off your debt. That's what slavery was in those days, right? But once you paid off your debt, then you're free, all right? And, you know, we talk about, you know, how slavery existed back in America some time ago, which was nothing like the slavery that existed in the Bible. But the slavery in the Bible only had to do with what was equitable, that is, paying off what you owe, all right, in the form of slavery. What the children of Israel did when they were in slavery was something altogether different. That was a whole race of people were enslaved by the Egyptians, right? And here in America and in Britain and in many other places, a whole race of people, and I use the word race loosely, were enslaved, which was totally unjust. Totally unjust, right? God condemns all that. What's really sad about it is, unfortunately, that many so-called Christians used God's word to justify it. And that's a perversion of what God taught. But anyway, I want to look at one final passage before we're close. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 9. And this is the one that I want to stress to all of us. When God gave his law, and he's showing Israel what is true justice, look at what he says. Verse 1. Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God and keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, So it will be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a large and beautiful cities which you did not build, and so forth. Look at how important it is from God's perspective that they wrote everything down, that they taught everything to their children. He says, I want you to even write it on the walls in your house. Write it on your doorpost. Speak of it with your children when you sit down, when you stand up, when you go to bed, when you, everything you do as you're interacting with your children, I want you to explain to them how what you're doing is in accordance to God's law, which set out this standard of justice, right? Teach it to your children. Drill it into their brains, because if you don't drill it into their brains, what's going to happen in the next generation? They forget the God who brought them out of Egypt. They forget the miracles that he did. They forget the promises that he made. And he goes on to say, and I think it's even in this chapter, that when you get in the land and God is going to prosper them, that they're going to, you know, they're going to have all this wealth and stuff, and then they're going to say, you know, I did this by my own power. And you're going to forget the Lord your God who gave you all that stuff. And that's exactly what they did. Now, where did the process break down? Where did the process break down? You tell me.
Define it a little better. You say process break down.
Why did Israel not remember? Why did they not? Why did impression they got of God who delivered them out of Egypt? Why did they turn away from him later? Why did they not remember? Generations down the road.
Was it during Joseph's time? Was it because the old people were killed off?
And then what? Vera, tell me.
They weren't taught.
They weren't taught by their fathers. That's where it broke down. See, the fathers received the experiences, they learned the lessons. If they didn't teach their sons, then their sons began, and generation after generation, they began to turn away from God because they didn't remember. They didn't remember. How important is it that the fathers teach their sons and their daughters the ways of God? How important is it that God's people do not intermarry with those who are pagans, those who do not worship God, and then you have that influence coming into your home as well? How important is that? Even in the New Testament, God forbids a Christian from marrying somebody who is not a true follower of Christ. It's forbidden. Why is that? Because of what's going to happen to the next generation. That's why. See, that's where it breaks down. The failure of the fathers to teach their children. The failure of the fathers to seek out godly women to marry. And then to teach their children. It comes down to the men. If the men had taken God's word to heart, the nation of Israel would not have gone through all the crud that they have gone through all down through the generations. And they've gone through a lot of crud. It's the failure of the men.